This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine, the consumer resource of pilots and aircraft owners.
Explain to me then about how the private instrument check ride would work. What, just the logistics of it. How does this work?
Well, the exemption that we have allows a student, well, first of all, the person that goes through the private instrument syllabus remains a student pilot until the day they become both private instruments simultaneously. And so that's a change, because ordinarily you'd go ahead and get your private pilot passed, and at that point, move on into the second leg of training and do the instrument at that point then, and they switch from student to private pilot. But in this case, they remain student pilots all the way through, and then when they go for the practical test, what happens is the regulation as it reads says, in order to go for to stand for the instrument rating check ride, you have to be the holder of a private pilot certificate. Well, none of our students are. They're still student pilots. So the exemption allows them to take the test as a student pilot.
And are you all the only one with such an exemption? Like, what is Cirrus going to do then? Do you know?
I do. We are the only one with the exemption right now that I know of. I'm pretty sure that's the case. In Cirrus's situation, you know, their approach was a little different than what we've done at the university. I believe they were keenly interested in ensuring that they kept their students in training, kind of under the umbrella of the training network all the way through the instrument. I think they have a specific idea that if a person were to buy a Cirrus, become a private pilot, that there's somewhat, that airplane has such a high level of technology that if you use it only for VFR, you're kind of falling short of its potential. Mm-hmm. But also one eye on the fact that I think they believe that in the long run, they'll have safer pilots and less accidents if they've kept them under their wing a little longer all the way through the instrument, rather than getting a private and kind of kicking them loose and hoping for the best. So I think that was really part of their strategy and part of their interest in doing it this way. But the syllabus I wrote for Cirrus is meant to be, it's a generic syllabus. It's meant to be adapted to different flight schools. For instance, if a flight school had a flight training device, some of the lessons in the syllabus could be substituted airplane for FTD. But I didn't write it like that because I couldn't assume that every school has an FTD. It could also be adapted for Part 141 if a school wanted to do so. They could add this to their training course outline and have it part of 141. And in that situation, they could adopt the other piece that we've done, and that piece is the fact that it's a competency-based syllabus. If it's straight 61, however, you're still subject to the Part 61 flight hours minimum times. And so if that's the case where you have to abide by all the Part 61 minimum times, then the syllabus could actually be a little bit longer. And we didn't know going in whether that meant that the flight times that the students would get would be, more or less. It turned out that the averages were much less, and so that sort of became the icing on the cake. But going in, I didn't really know how much time it was going to take. Mm-hmm. From a business standpoint, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of students, a lot of pilots who would get their private license and then kind of fall by the wayside and maybe never get their instrument rating. And, I have not got a ton of experience in a Cirrus. I have not gone through their instructor program myself, but to me, if you had that airplane and you only ever use it for VFR, it's like, it'd be like getting a plasma TV and only watching black and white shows on it. I mean, it doesn't seem like you're using the equipment to its intended purpose. And I think they have that in mind too. They really would like to have some pilots that would kind of raise the bar. And ultimately, I don't know if this is a concept that'll work, but ultimately I see the private pilot certificate differently than it has been in the past. I think that the private instrument with today's technology and these airplanes really that's the target. If a person wants to just fly VFR and just, you know, just fly around for the fun of it, then the sport pilot certificate is there now.
Right.
So I kind of think that the sport pilot is sort of the new private, and the private is sort of the new instrument. Because you know, when I got my private pilot's license, I was a long time ago in a round dial airplane, of course, and these private instruments were completely separate things. But really now I think the technology has helped blend those things. So I think we kind of have to train in that direction if it's going to make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Your test case was a very specific demographic of students who, you know, according to your research data, were successful. But how do you think other people can achieve the same level of success just given the demographic? Like, you know, these were, you know, what, 19, 20, 21-year-old students,
right,
in college who presumably didn't have kids and jobs and mortgages,
right,
and all they were doing was flying and studying and plowing through this. But would you reasonably expect, you know, a 40-something married working professional to have that demographic group to have the same level of success with a combined private instrument, given that it looked like at least part of the reason for the success was the fact that it was done quickly, and information was retained from one lesson to the other? Like, what do you see as some potential stumbling blocks or modifications that would need to be,
sure,
made for this program for people that are outside of the university environment?
The lessons, the syllabus lessons, go to great lengths to try to provide the student with a lot of input and a lot of rationale for why we're doing it. I mean, the whole idea of a scenario is to show that this is something that you might actually do later on when you are, you know, attain your private pilot certificate, how you might utilize your airplane, so they can see a connection between what we're doing in flight training and how they see themselves using their plane in the future. And sometimes you don't have that same connection when all you're doing is flight maneuvers. You know, if you're going to go out and do an hour of, you know, just following roads or whatever, there may be some real value in that as from the standpoint of piloting skills, but pilots don't really, you know, you're a flight instructor, so you know that sometimes there's not a really good connection between what we're doing and why we're doing it with what we're going to need. And this is a classic thing. If, you know, if a student is a wonderful person, has great skills when they can do turns around a point and short field landings and so forth, but when they get their private pilot's license, what's the first thing they do? They load up their family and fly off to Disney World, which we didn't really train them to do that. We
right.
just trained them to fly around in the practice area. But so that's why I'm very interested now in seeing how, you know, how we can implement and ultimately get some results working with the Cirrus folks. So I think it'll work, and here's another reason. I mean, the syllabus and the scenario-based training, you know, it does have somewhat of a flow to it, and so I think that if I'm a 50-something business person and I'm going to buy an airplane for its utility, not only for its ability for me to fly it for pleasure, but also to use it in my business and see it as an additional business tool. Well, if for me to be in a position to think this, I must have been somewhat successful. I must know a deal when I see it. And if I go to the airport to learn to fly and it seems disorganized, if it seems like there's cost overruns, I mean, the national average to get a private pilot's license, I hear different numbers, but it's somewhere around the 60-65 range. But if I was told earlier that it's 40 hours to get a private pilot's license, and now it's costing and taking more time by almost a 50% increase, then I'm resistant to that. That's not the world I'm used to. If I have a contractor that can't get the job done on time and on budget, I use somebody else. So I really think that the syllabus kind of speaks to those kind of folks because it is more concise. It seems to be more realistic, and it seems to stay on path. In other words, there's not all these extras that seem to creep into flight training that make that time go up and up and up and make the cost of what you thought was going to be, you know, $6,000 all of a sudden it's $12,000, and
right, there is a sort of efficiency model built into this that would be appealing to that demographic.
Well, that's what I think. Now, like I said, this is my hunch.
Right.
But I'd really like 100 people in that demographic to try it and then tell us, but and it hasn't happened yet. But I really feel like that what I saw from the students and what I've talked about with other potential students in that demographic, that this is a sort of an appealing thing, that it's more going to align with what they're used to. And they'll be the first ones to quit if it's not that way. If the traditional come in, the flying center's got his cap on backwards, what do you want to do today kind of thing, is not going to work for them.
In one of the documents, there was a survey of sorts of the students after they finished, and you asked them questions about their confidence level dealing with airspace, dealing with weather, and flying an approach to minimums. And I found it interesting that the students that finished the combined syllabus, at least in your survey, reported that they felt more confident handling such tasks than the students that had gone through a traditional syllabus, separately, private and then instrument, even though the combined group had fewer hours. Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense as to whether or not that confidence is real? Or, in this context, now that you're compressing the time even more, how can you really, really give the students that quality of experience, not just covering all the bases, but really the quality of experience that will let them make safe judgments once they complete the program?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, because, the market today is different than it was a year ago. A year ago, I was having my flight instructors who worked for us, we couldn't keep them. This moment they were graduates and had 400 flight hours, they were gone. That slowed down some this year, and that's not probably a bad thing. But you're right. So the theory is, if they're going to go at that low time, then what can we do in the time that we have them to increase the quality, so that we aren't just sending somebody out who's just, very, very green and naive of, the real world situations. And so I guess that maybe sort of the heart of the whole concept is to try to train more like they will ultimately fly. That's the thought. The one of the big issues, and a lot of flight instructors, when they hear about this concept, they say something like, well, I've been using scenarios my whole career. Why is this different? And they're right. Good flight instructors have always put students in, quote, scenarios where they're flying along and something happens and, do we have to make a decision and that kind of thing. But the difference in this is that in a normal training environment, and I've been a flight instructor for 27 years, so I've done this a million times where we're flying along and we were supposed to fly from, down to Chattanooga, Tennessee, for instance, and then somewhere along the way we pose a scenario to the student where there's a line of thunder showers and then what are you going to do now? And so the rote answer is, well, I guess we're going to have to divert. And so they pick another airport, and now I'm evaluating their ability to kind of replan the flight on the fly and pick a new heading and figure out if I have enough fuel to get there and then make a diversion. And those are all good skills, but what's missing from that is that if that's all you do, it's not the same environment that the student will be in later, because we didn't talk about what the consequences were for not making it to Chattanooga. If there's a consequence involved, like, for instance, we have many examples of how, we're going to Chattanooga for a particular reason. Let's say we're going down there, for a family reunion. And so if you get down halfway there and have to make the decision to divert, in a training environment, there's no consequence. There's no big deal. You're just testing about going to an alternate airport. Whereas if that was a real situation, that pilot would feel pressured to continue on, because how many people are going to be disappointed that they didn't get there, or they didn't bring something to the, they didn't arrive. They didn't take a contract. They didn't, all these little scenarios that require you to go to Chattanooga. So in a real situation, when there's pressure, real pressure to get there, that'll be completely a different situation than it's just a training exercise where the students expect to divert. I mean, how many lessons do we have where we say, okay, plan this flight down to Atlanta, and they know good and well we have no intention of actually going to Atlanta. You know, they know students, you know, they're smart. They'll figure this out. And in one of our traditional syllabus lessons, I noticed that the students started calling it the diversion flight. It's like there was no surprise. They knew it was a diversion flight. They knew they were not going to really go to the planned place. So there was no consequence when they didn't go. But in an actual situation where I've got, you know, an elderly, you know, grandmother in the right seat, and I'm taking her to her family reunion for her 80th birthday or whatever, if I don't get down there, I'm never going to get invited to Christmas again by the family. That's pressure that they have to deal with in the real world that is absent from traditional training.
Right.
So what we try to do is put them in those situations all the time so that they're continuously practicing, you know, what's the best way to do it, and so when they get on their own, it's not like they've never made a decision before.
Right.
It's like that was part of the training, so they should be able to do a better job of it than that example before where I said, you know, and I've done this. So I've trained the students to pass the check ride, and they're really good pilots, and their stick and rudder skills are excellent. But then they don't really use those skills like we trained. They jump in the plane, and they're headed off for a golfing weekend with the buddies, and you're thinking the decisions that they'll have to face when they do that, we didn't really talk about those during training. We were just talking about, you know, holding the airspeed right and stuff like that. So this hopefully will produce a student who emerges having been so inundated with this decision-making atmosphere during the training that it'll be just second nature for them when they get out. If that were to actually work, if that theory were to come true, then someone who did have less hours would still be a better decision-maker, and that hours don't really translate one for one. You know, you can't say, well, all 1,000-hour pilots are better decision-makers than all 500-hour pilots. You can't say that now. But I think we'd be moving toward an inter direction so that decision making is just a part of every flight, not just something that comes up, you know, when they get under pressure. So I think going back to that survey you're talking about, I don't have it in front of me, but yes, the private instrument combination students with less time did report greater confidence, but also one of the survey questions dealt with their personal minimums. And like I said, I don't have it in front of me, so I can't quote it, but their personal minimums were higher than the minimums that were reported by the traditionally trained students.
That is correct, I remember.
Yeah, and so I think part of the reason that they had greater confidence is because I think they had better confidence in their own decision-making to not put themselves in compromising or dangerous positions. Some of the students that we asked about personal minimums who were traditionally trained had not really thought about that, and we're saying, well, you know, the ILS is 200 overcast and a half. I guess that's my minimums, and it never entered their mind really that might be legal, but that's not smart. If you're, you know, you kind of have to work your way down with the concept of personal minimums, and they just didn't have that idea. They never thought about it. Whereas our decision training group, they were probably more apt to. I think their personal minimums came out on average to be almost VFR.
Yeah.
So that they were going to be more cautious, and we thought that was sort of a cause and effect thing. Yeah, they had more confidence, but it wasn't that they were taking, you know, flights down to 200 and a half, and they were real solid, confident to do that. It was more that they had more confidence in their decision-making that they would use personal minimums and not find themselves in a position that was going to be in over their head.
Right. They had developed more of a, would you call it a mature understanding of risk management?
Mature. I sometimes use the word savvy. They sort of sort of a system savvy about them that it goes back to this whole thing we said a minute ago about decision making. Can they make a decision that will help them stay safe? And it seemed like to us that the people that had such an emphasis on decision making during their normal training, it's not just an afterthought toward the end, but at every step, had more confidence that they would make the right decision, and that gave them more confidence that they would be safe in the system, because After all, there was going to be some things they weren't going to be there for because they will have opted out. Where traditionally trained students would think, well, it's legal to go. What's the question? Let's just go. And then they get in over their heads. And
you know. Paul, one more question, then I'll let you go. Thank you so much for your time today.
Of course.
How dependent is all of this on the technology that's available to the student? You know, obviously this was all conceptualized to go along with and think ahead in terms of, you know, technically advanced aircraft and glass panel and GPS, et cetera, students that, you know, are going to be traveling more across country rather than, you know, tootling around their local area. But not everybody that may be interested in doing this has access to those things. Not every flight school may have access to a simulator or an FTD. How dependent is success on the technology, or can you just as easily complete this in a, you know, Cessna 172 with a dual VOR nav?
Well, this is one of the discoveries of this whole thing that I have learned that I'm as confident about in saying this as any, and that is I think this is an educational methodology that is transferable to anything. You could do this with a fleet of J3 Cubs, and it would still work. But you are right. It was originally ushered in under the theory that if you look back over aviation history, whenever there has been an introduction of new technology, it has been almost immediately followed by a spike in accidents. Mm-hmm. So here we were going to introduce one of the biggest steps in technology in aviation history. So, you know, we were all, you, me, everybody was worried that this was going to be create a flock of accidents. And so my whole mission was to try to train all those out, to try to get out in front of it to the point where we could head this spike off at the pass. And so it certainly was the technically advanced aircraft introduction in the general aviation market that sparked it. But once we got in it, it's clear to me that the way you train is not dependent on the aircraft you're in. And and now at our flight school, we have a combination. We have 25 airplanes, and we do the primary and instrument training in 20 of them. They're Diamond DA-40s. Well, of those, about half are still round dials, and the other half, you know, we haven't been able to switch over all of them yet. And so our students train in both things, and we're not seeing a big problem or difference with that. So I think it's just how you do it, not what you do it in. And I think that's a good message for all flight schools, because you do not have to spend, you know, $1 million on FTDs and new avionics. I am convinced that the methodology works no matter what you already have. And having the new technology is great. I'm certainly not discouraging people from pursuing it, but it's not something that keeps you out of the party here with the new scenario training idea. So, if there's any clear message, we think we have some very strong empirical data to show that if it's done right, it doesn't matter what airplane you're in.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine. For more information on Aviation Consumer, log on to www.aviationconsumer.com.